The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
Today's programme is devoted to looking at whether religion and politics can mix. A simple enough question, but there are times when people with strong religious convictions find themselves on a collision course with political parties on matters of conscience. With me today to explore the tensions are three people who will be coming at this from very different angles. Christina Summers served as a city councillor from 2011 till 2015, first as a member of the Green administration and then latterly as an independent. She is a devout Christian. Lloyd Russell Moyle is a newly elected Labour Member of Parliament for Kemp Town, as well as being a city councillor for East Brighton. He is an avowed humanist. Finally with me in the studio is the Reverend Anthea Ballam, who, as an interfaith minister, was a familiar figure during the mayoralty of Councillor Pete West, leading prayers before full council and at numerous engagements fulfilled by the mayor during his term. So, welcome to the studio. Christina, tell us your story. Now, you had, as I said in my introduction, you started out as a Green councillor and then went independent. What prompted that?
My Green colleagues.
Yeah, well, precisely, that's pretty generalist. Just be a bit more specific. What happened?
Very briefly, there was a notice of motion that was tabled in July 2012 by the Labour group, basically to say that Brighton just write to David Cameron and just endorse his intention to introduce same-sex marriage. And it's something that I discussed with my colleagues, saying, listen, I can't actually agree with this on just conscience alone, but also for various other reasons. So I'm not going to be able to vote in favour of it, but I'll also speak to it to explain why and make very clear what the Green policy was for that. Unfortunately, you know, to cut a long story short, there was great disagreement. There was a disciplinary procedure. Then there was a voting that I should leave the group, and which automatically I became independent by about September, I think it was.
Right. So you understood, of course, that it was like a red line for the Green Party on equal marriage when you signed up to be part of their group.
No, I did not understand that there was a red line at all. It wasn't even really an issue that was, you know, in our local manifesto. I stood on the local manifesto of the Green Party. Marriage was not an issue at all on there. You know, if there had been, then I may have thought twice about standing and obviously discussed it with my colleagues. But this was somewhat out of the blue, even from David Cameron.
My understanding was that equalities was a firm tenet of the Green Party. That might have given you a hint, I guess.
Well, yes, but, you know, I don't know about you, but I've signed many general equality statements like that one. It's very general. It's a catch-all equality statement, including, you know, equality for those with religious belief. So, in principle, of course I agreed with that, and that was done in all conscience. Yes.
Now, I mean, this programme is about where people like yourself with deeply held religious convictions come into contact with political parties who have similar tenets, mm-hmm. and they would stand by. Now, going back a bit, you also drew attention to yourself by going out and supporting some friends who were lobbying outside an abortion clinic. This too seemed to cause some consternation. Just talk me through what happened there.
Well, yeah, it did cause some consternation amongst my Green colleagues. I think I discovered they get consterned very easily, and I think made a real big mountain out of a molehill, really. It was something that was done at last moment to support one person who was standing there literally giving out literature. There was no lobbying or intimidating. I wouldn't have agreed with that. That was a last-minute call for help, so I went along there, and that was it. as fate would have it, somebody was taking photographs, and before long, there it was up on Twitter, taken out of context, all the usual abuse, etc. And of course, that set off the rather more expressive members of the Green Group. And yes, that did set it on the road to distrust.
We'll come back to that issue of abuse. Anthea, I seem to recall at the time you tried to pour oil on troubled waters when Christina was falling foul of the Green Party.
I think it's really important to respect people's views. I mean, what's interesting is that the one that Christina was talking about particularly is one that I do feel very strongly about, and I think women do have a right to decide for their own, for themselves and their own bodies, because so many things happen and it's so much easier for blokes than it is for women. You know, if you make a mistake, you suddenly find yourself pregnant and so on. So that is one I feel very strongly about, but I do also passionately endorse her right to her point of view, and I think that we all have to do this. I think it is absolutely essential that we respect other people's opinions, even if they aren't the same as ours. And I think, you know, I think Voltaire said that a couple of hundred years ago, and I believe that myself. I think it is so important to say you have a right to your point of view. I don't like your point of view, and were I about to go into an abortion clinic and have somebody stop me when my conscience was kind of in an uncertain and unhappy place, but I was convinced that I was making the right decision, I could do without that kind of lobby. But at the same time, I simply feel that to say somebody who comes into our party, particularly something as broad as the Greens, has the right to their point of view, and it should be honoured, and I feel passionately about that. Freedom of any vision, view, is important.
Now, Lloyd, you're an avowed humanist.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't around when Christina was having to navigate the choppy seas. Your colleague, your ward colleague, because you're still, as I said in my introduction, still a ward councillor. We might ask you when there's going to be a by-election, but I doubt whether you're going to tell us.
I'm sure sometime in the next year or so.
One time, yes, of course. Anyway, now, Warren Morgan brought the motion. Do you think this was political game-playing in order to flush out any naysayers, or was it a genuine notice of motion?
I can't speak for the detailed motivations of my political colleagues. What I can say is that notice of motions generally are statements of intent and belief. They are generally about instructing the council to write to the authorities or to make it clear the authorities' view on things. So it seems totally correct that Brighton and Hove, which has one of the highest LGBT populations in the country, has one of the biggest prides in the country, would, as an authority, want to say, we support this further step towards equal marriage. We've just seen the 50 years of being gay in Brighton programme that Sam Fanshawe made on the BBC, and so Brighton has a long history of some of those fights, and so it would seem very reasonable for that to come to the council. Now, as I say, I'm sure that it could have been something that the Labour Party could have brought. Sometimes we bring things jointly with other groups as well, and that might have been a possibility, but I'm not quite sure whether it would have changed the outcome, because I suspect the outcome would have been that the Labour group would have pushed forward for it with the Green group as well as a joint motion if it had been there. So I suspect it didn't make much difference that it was Labour putting it forward, or it was Greens putting it forward, or even some of the Conservatives. And we have some Conservative who would support it and did as well.
But do you find, you kind of touched on a quite interesting point, because if you think in politics, there are times where people with party whips who are governed by party whips are too scared to come forward and say what their views truly are in case they seem out of step with the mainstream. You know, we've got a debate going on in the Australian Parliament right now. We had a woman turning up in a burqa to make a point that the burqas should be banned in Australia. And, of course, people were outraged by this, but they're also going to have a referendum very shortly about equal marriage, and this is a non-binding referendum. So do you think sometimes politicians are a bit timid, and perhaps politicians or ex-politicians such as Christina are the minority because they have the courage of their convictions to say what they actually think and vote the way they think?
I think a politician has to balance what you personally believe and fulfilling the will of your constituents and your voters. And it is always a dilemma, a struggle that every politician has to countenance with every day to some extent. You know, kind of, there is a discussion that I have in my office every day, probably at the moment, about Brexit. You know, kind of, my personal view would be that I would want us not to be going forward with Brexit, but equally there was a referendum that said that we should go out of the European Union. So how do you square those things? And sometimes you say, well, I have to go with the majority and my party. And other times I think it is right that people say this is a issue of conscience. I have to go with my conscience. But by doing that, it doesn't mean that there are no consequences. I think we have free speech, but free speech doesn't mean your speech is inconsequential in terms of your future career. And I think we have to understand that. If we have free speech without any consequences, you actually get into a very dangerous situation that you sometimes see even on Twitter and Facebook, where people think they can say whatever they want without any consequences, and it turns very nasty and very aggressive. So speech needs consequences, but equally it shouldn't be shut down and stopped because of it. And there is that balance between them.
Christina, you experienced the online abuse following your vote against the motion. What did that feel like, or did you draw on the strength of your religious beliefs to bring you through that? Were there dark moments?
No, I think it's not as simple as that. Really, drawing on one's religious beliefs—that sounds all very cerebral, really. Or, on the other hand, emotional. It's none of those things at all. Of course, I'm human. No one likes to be called fascist or whatever. You know, if there was a choice not to be, you'd prefer not to. However, actually, it was a real test to see, you know, was that actually going to affect who I am and how I position myself? Or, you know, am I going to see that as water under the bridge? And I think over a reasonably short period of time, it did wash over me. In the end, they're just words. They're not true. Those labels. We are in a time now where we love to label one another, which automatically means, oh, that person is that, so we don't need to speak with them, or they hold all these views and they're therefore written off. And I know you, Geoffrey, are a man of, you know, great ability to speak to those with different views and not write them off. And I've always appreciated that about you. So, yes, it wasn't pleasant, but you know what? I actually don't care. When I see it continues, of course, but it doesn't shape me. It doesn't bother me that much. And, you know, I appreciate what you said about freedom of speech and boundaries. Boundaries are absolutely crucial, but I'm still very concerned about the consequences of what one says. There are consequences, of course, but I don't think that it needs to automatically mean that, you know, you're lambasted and labelled, you know, a heretic or something just because you've expressed a point of view that is sincere.
OK. We're going to take a break there, and we're going to break this very serious topic up, have some music choices from our guests, and we're turning to Anthea Ballon first, who has come armed with a compilation. She assures me it is not the entire Ring cycle from Wagner, because the programme's not long enough. And perhaps you'll tell us what piece of music you have selected for this programme and why.
I had a terrible problem, Geoffrey, but I've put first the Aretha Franklin, What a Fool Believes, because that's absolutely amazing. In fact, there's lots of Aretha Franklin here. I think there's three singers here. It's Aretha Franklin, There's Shirley Horn, absolutely amazing, and Eliane Elias, who's not known in this country, but is probably the best jazz pianist in the world. So I've got a really good choice, and she also sings beautifully.
Now, so that does sound like a lot of fences in here. Yeah. Which one is your choice?
I'm going for What a Fool Believes, Aretha Franklin, which is absolutely stunning. It's a Doobie Brothers song, and it's her own version of it. There's also a nice version of one of the Adele hits as well, there.
Okay, let's take a break and listen to that. What a fool. I want to now turn to the trials and tribulations of the Labour Party. Now, the Labour Party, I noticed, Lloyd, that you've been in a Twitter spat with one of your colleagues, Caroline Penn, and anyone who can hear a little bark in the background is because I'm joined in the studio here, not by Caroline Penn, by Clover, the Irish Terrier, who has an opinion about Twitter spats, by the sound of it. Anyway, you had a little Twitter spat with her because you appeared to support a Labour Party member who'd been accused of anti-Semitism. Give us your take on what that was all about.
Well, as with most of these things on Twitter, storm in the teacup. There was a Labour Party member that was suspended and expelled from the party. She was suspended and expelled actually because she had, very stupidly in my view, tweeted support of George Galloway a number of times. Nothing particularly anti-Semitic, apart from the fact that George Galloway could be accused of difficult things, but herself in that. And I wrote a letter of support saying that she had immediately taken down the Twitter and apologised. Along with her letter of expulsion, she was also told that if she hadn't have been expelled for that, there would have been an investigation into another incredibly stupid tweet that she put out, saying that the Israeli authorities had faked the sarin gas attack in Syria. Incredibly stupid and naive. She contacted me and said that she meant it as a parody to point out how stupid these conspiracy theories are. Her husband is Jewish, a lot of her friends are Jewish. She had no intention of actually believing that theory, but she was trying to point out how bonkers it sounds. Unfortunately, on Twitter, it doesn't come across like that. It comes across like she was just supporting that issue. Now, that's what she told me. On face value, I wrote a letter to the General Secretary after the General Secretary of the Labour Party asked me about this case and the view of it, laying out what I believe, that both things were incredibly stupid. But they were things that if someone truly was regretful and truly was apologetic for and promised not to do again, they could be let into the party. Some people felt like she hadn't been truly sorry and she'd continue to do it. And I, in the Twitter exchange, have said if she does continue to do it, clearly that's something that would prevent her from being part of the party. So that's where the spat was. As with all these things, it gets blown up into a polemic, them versus us. Caroline Penn and me have spoken about it since, and it's water under a bridge, really, but it's one of those things.
But it's out in the public, of course. So.
Of course, it's one of those things that's unfortunate.
And it kind of reminded the public that the Labour Party has had some of these issues before it in recent months. Now, I don't know whether that's relating to the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, who's had a long-standing support of the Palestinian cause, and people have seemed to have equated that with anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Is that your belief where this might stem from?
Yes, of course there are anti-Semites on the left of politics as well as there are on the right. There are the Labour Party, just like the Green Party and the Liberal Party, reflect society in many ways, and if there is racism and anti-Semitism in society, there will be some within a party. Now, a party needs to make sure they stamp it out when they find it, and they kind of re-educate people when they have offensive views and all those kinds of things. And so there's always been some of that. I think that there is an element now that people feel like this is the moment to bring those issues up, because it's harder to attack Jeremy Corbyn on other issues. I think equally, generally in Britain, and not just in the Labour Party, a lot of Jews seem to be saying that they are worried about a rise of anti-Semitism. A lot of Muslims are talking about a rise of Islamophobia. So there is a rise of hatred across Britain. And so when those things are all happening, then I think that we suddenly have to look closer at ourselves, at making sure that we are better than the rest. And of course, the Labour Party is having and has done that. And we have got some motions coming up to conferences here in Brighton this year to say that if someone is found to be a racist or an anti-Semite or anti-Islamophobic and it can be clearly proven, then it should be automatic expulsion territory. And those are discussions that we will have, and I suspect that that will pass.
So the member or the ex-member who you were having this exchange with, Caroline Penn, you're convinced she's not an anti-Semite. She's her partner is Jewish, but we could have I don't know, Salem witch trials in order to prove people are homophobic, anti-Semite, Islamophobic, in order to expunge them from the Labour Party. Is that what we have in store, do you think?
Well, my view is if you have got overt racists and or anti-Semites, and anti-Semitism is a form of racism, so, you know, kind of that's the catch-all, then they don't have a place in the Labour Party, and they need to either reform or leave. I do believe that people should be given the option of reforming, of repenting. I think that is an important process of people realising that they have done wrong. And that's what my letter on the particular person was about, not saying what they'd done was right or wrong, but saying that there should be a process of repentance and a process of apology. If there isn't, then yes, people do have to say goodbye to the Labour Party, and I would hope that other parties would say something similarly. But there should be a process. There should be a process for people to be able to put their hands up and say, I've done it wrong. Now, there's always a line, isn't there, going to be? If someone's an axe murderer and then they turn around and say, well, I'm terribly sorry, well, clearly that goes beyond the pale. So there's always a line here. But I think with belief, the line is much more blurred, and one has to be much more careful about that. But if people are offensive, unduly, particularly around people with specialised characteristics, then we have to take action.
Anthea, I want to bring you in here because you have a rather special place in the studio. You're an interfaith minister,
yep,
and you're very active in bringing different faiths together. We all, actually two of us, three of us, attended the Dialogue mm-hmm. Society's dinner at the Grand, breaking the fast at Ramadan, and it was actually very uplifting because there were bishops and imams and all sorts of people there of faith, and a message that came over from the keynote speaker was around the rise in Islamophobia. Do we have this in Brighton as well?
I don't think it... I mean, this is something that I'm fighting very strongly, because I'm the secretary of the Interfaith Contact Group, which is the organisation which brings people of all faiths and none, together. In fact, our treasurer is an atheist. But it's an organisation that actually embraces all faiths and brings them together in a sort of social situation or an educational system or a fun situation where people can exchange ideas and realise that they have more in common. They're not in common. And it's a wonderful organisation, the Interfaith Contact Group, because in Brighton particularly, it's extremely broad. It's much more broad than our umbrella organisation, which is based in London, which is probably a government partially sort of sponsored organisation, which is more limited to a certain number of faiths. But in Brighton, we're much more open. And as I say, we include everybody. And it's very important that we confront Islamophobia, and we find ways of overcoming it. But there's always going to be that problem. There's always going to be people who hold prejudice because they read a particular newspaper that implants a particular idea in their head for political reasons. Politicians are massively responsible
yes,
for
I
racism.
Yes, I was going to say that. Sometimes an ill-chosen word or a politician
posing in front of a poster, which implies something particularly nasty.
Absolutely.
Does seem to give license to people to express their hatred.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I tend to think that politics uses racial discrimination and religion as a tool for dotting people on the head. I mean, it's so fascinating, this thing about the anti-Semitism and the Labour Party. I mean, this is actually based on the fact that people don't seem to understand that supporting the Palestinian cause or not supporting it is something to do with, you know, the Jews. And actually, it's got nothing to do with it. It's got to do with Zionism. It's got to do with a very complicated situation in the Middle East. And, you know, people saying that they support one side or the other actually has nothing to do with it at all. It's a very tragic and horrific situation that is probably at the kind of grassroots, actually tribal.
I think it's true to say that even the Green Party has come in for accusations of anti-Semitism because of its long-standing championing of the Palestinian cause.
Well, you know, championing the Palestinian cause is a very good thing, in a sense. I mean, obviously, the Palestinians need to have a country, and we need to accept that and, you know, go along with that. But saying that one belief is actually to be held at the exclusion of another is just stupid, because it isn't like that. It's far, far more complicated. It goes back, you know, 60, 70, 80 years and much more. And it's just stupid to actually say, well, I support one thing to the exclusion of the other. We just really need to accept that people need to live in peace. They need a space to do so. And if we allow ourselves to share, you know, everybody has an opportunity to be alive. And that's really where we need to come from.
Now, we haven't got a member of the Conservative Party here in the studio today. But I just wonder whether I could get your take. It's a minority administration. As a result of the general election, which saw Lloyd sweep to power, or sweep almost
to power.
Not
to power, unfortunately.
It may only be a matter of time, who knows. But, you know, we saw a massive turnaround in the fortunes of the Labour Party, but not enough to produce an overall majority for the Conservatives, who have done a deal with the Democratic Unionist Party, whose party is populated with people with deeply held religious convictions. And some of those convictions, as I've said in the introduction, are out of line with mainstream thinking on the mainland. Now, do you think that the Conservative Party brand is being somehow... They've done some great things, and we should take our hats off to David Cameron, who brought in equal marriage, to Tony Blair, who brought in civil partnerships. Do you think it's damaged brand Conservative by coming into this relationship with the DUP? Okay. Anthea, your eyes are popping.
Well, my eyes are popping because I just think that a government that says no, 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 and goes on saying this word austerity, 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 and then suddenly finds £1.5 billion to be forked out to a minority party which represents not all that many people, in order to prop it up after it had an election, in order to prove to everybody it was loved and failed to do so, is actually doing something that is ethically unacceptable. That's my view on it.
But you don't... What about the fact that they've got into bed, in the nicest possible sense in this religious context, with the DUP, who holds such strong views?
I don't even think their views are relevant. I think that what they have done is ethically unacceptable. If it was a party of the extreme left or the extreme right that was not of their own, which it's not of their own, it would be equally unacceptable.
I think I agree it's unacceptable to have this kind of bung or bribe, as I think most people would see it. I think even, however, if we remove the money element, I suspect the DUP wouldn't have done the deal without the money, but if we did remove the money element, would it be acceptable to go into bed, as you put it, with the DUP? I suspect not. I remember the UK was the first government to sponsor a floating New York Pride when I was working at the UN. and it was a very proud moment, actually. The only country of all the UN nations that sponsored a float, and we marched together, all UN employees from the UK and our consulate staff and our mission staff. And on that, a number of the people from Northern Ireland, staff members of the British government, Northern Ireland, wore T-shirts saying no equal marriage, no equal rights in Northern Ireland, the fight continues. Now, I wonder if they would be allowed to do that now, that the DUP are having to prop up the government and they're having to work for the government. It's a dangerous slope that you go down. The other thing that I think is important to counter is the DUP don't... Northern Irish people and people in Ireland are not against things like gay marriage, are not actually against things like limited abortion. It's unfortunately some of their politicians that continue to be out of step with the population. And you saw that in the Republic of Ireland, where the referenda swept through relatively easily. And when you go to Northern Ireland and you ask people, they say they vote for the DUP for other reasons. And when you ask about some of the issues and some of their beliefs on gay marriage, people will often say, well, actually, on that bit, we don't kind of really agree with them. And so there is a danger now that it doesn't allow other parties and the UK government to stand up where the DUP is actually not aligned with their people's views.
Christina, I'm going to turn to you now. This is your Desert Island Disc moment. Tell us about your music that you've chosen and why you've chosen it.
Okay. Well, mine isn't as well thought through as Anthea's, and it's by no means at that same sort of cultural level, seeing as I thought of it on the bike on the way down. I love so many different types of music. You know, when people say, oh, I don't like this particular group, I might not like the group, but if they produce a song I like, I'll listen to it. I love it. And I think in the end, you know, you said what a piece of music that sort of means something to you. Okay, well, it doesn't mean everything to me, but because it kind of reminds me of times gone by as a schoolgirl, those 1970s groups I loved. They were such fun. So one of my favourite groups was 10cc. That just, of course, puts me exactly on that historical timeline now. And I think probably one of their greatest hits then was I'm Not In Love. It's something that really had a very different sound at that time. Shot to number one, broke all sorts of records. And I listened to it again the other day, not having heard it for decades. And it still stirred in me something of my school years, etc. So it's just a moment in time.
Okay, well, let's bring back Christina's school days and listen to I'm Not In Love. Now, we were talking about the DUP, and I was going to turn to Christina because they do have some strongly held beliefs, much a bit driven by their religious convictions. See where they're coming from on the issues of equal marriage and abortion?
Well, that's probably a rhetorical question, seeing as what our opening discussions were about. Yes, I do. But I do want to take slight issue with the way that you phrase things, that strongly held beliefs. I know you've said that I have strongly held beliefs. Sometimes that can come across as a euphemism for extremism. And that, I would say, you know, I hope most people have strongly held beliefs. It's whether they express them or not, or whether they feel they have the freedom to express them without any repercussions, that you were talking about, Lloyd. So on those two issues, yes, I do see where they are coming from. DUP is not in for it just for their own party. Let's not forget that they're representing, you know, Ireland, Northern Ireland. It's not that they are, yet another party within the Westminster bubble. That's not the case. It's quite a different dynamic here. But simply on those two issues, yes, I do. I believe that everyone has a right to life, including the baby within the womb. I don't think that anyone has a right to take that away. That's a principle.
Would even if a woman has been raped?
Okay, well, that argument is often brought. If you would do a deal with me, Geoffrey, to say, okay, I will allow the 2% of abortions on that particular
for that particular reason to go by, to be allowed, if we are allowed to save the other 98%. That's often brought as the argument, but it's a minimal number and you can't make laws on that. Rape is obviously terrible, disgusting, but that doesn't give a right then to take another life because of that. So they're strongly held beliefs. They have been for forever. And of course, you know my views on same-sex marriage, which is euphemised and called equal marriage, because if we come against that, you're saying you're coming against equality. I think there's a little bit of use of language there.
How's it euphemised by saying equal marriage? I don't understand the euphemism there. I understand some of the other euphemisms that you meant.
If you like,
about
the implications of calling it equal marriage, then is that those who disagree with it disagree with equality. That there's a deliberate link there.
But how do you not disagree with equality in marriage? If you disagree with equality in marriage, you disagree with equality in marriage. Stand up and be happy about it and say, OK, I disagree with equality in marriage. I don't think that should be something that people have equal access to.
Yeah, I get your point, Lloyd. But yeah. my argument there was then you're trying to redefine what marriage is and always has been. That's a different argument. I absolutely agree with equality as far as
marriage is
equal
a word in the English. In the English dictionary, it's not owned by anyone in particular.
Well, then you can say that about any word, can't
yes,
you?
Yes, and if you can redefine, and words change and meanings change.
But who decides what words should change
the
and
legal,
then change the law?
The legal understanding of the law is the public and the parliament.
Yes, surely
no
public,
one else.
Yes, surely public mores do change. There was a time where all political parties supported slavery, and the churches did too. They were four square behind it. There's a great debate going on in the United States as we mm-hmm. record this program about glorifying people who were slave owners. And as even His Saintness Donald Trump pointed out, the founding fathers of the United States were slave owners.
Well, I think, yes. We're going off on all sorts of tributaries
but
here.
But we're just
we
saying
could say, let's
about,
bring down every
but you
statue.
Asked,
then,
you asked,
you know,
Lloyd,
no,
the question
but you're
about...
right, Geoffrey. You asked. Times change and yeah. views change. Absolutely.
And it
right.
doesn't mean
but
that we go back and condemn our people of the past completely. Of course, they did things in their time. But you do have to expect everyone in the here and now to move with, to some extent, the times, otherwise they get left behind. And principles do change. And going back to marriage actually has been a changing institution over the centuries, you know, kind of, whereas before it was acceptable at points to get married to close relatives, that became unacceptable, whereas before it was unacceptable to marry people of different races, that now became acceptable. The concept of marriage has changed.
And divorce.
And continues
and
to
divorce,
change.
And divorce
continues
was...
to change. And we can't predict where it will go. It might even be abolished completely eventually, for goodness sake. Or it might, you know, kind of stay where it is. It might have met the apex of where it's going to go, and the moral debate moves on to another thing. But everything in terms of morals changes. The point of where, and on this show, surely, is about kind of the interlinking between religion and politics and political discourse. Religion should, of course, be, and faith, or you know, kind of belief in that wider sense, be a starting point for political discussions. But it can't be the ending point. Because if it's the ending point, all we do is end up kind of saying what we believe to each other and walk away, and we've not come to a conclusion of how society lives and how we live with each other. The starting point is our beliefs, but the ending point needs to be a political discourse and discussion that will involve a compromise and being able to work with each other.
Why political discourse?
Well, I mean, I would say all discourse is political.
Marriage for many people, Lloyd, is actually a purely materialistic decision, which is actually affected by what the taxation system is and how it protects people. Interestingly, Christina is actually talking about it as a holy, I assume, as a meaningful and spiritual gesture.
No, actually,
you're
not. No, I'm not. And that's the misconception there is. It's that the point of marriage, certainly from not just a biblical point of view, but historically, has not been, love has not in itself been the basis of it. And that's always been the argument. Why should you stop two people who love each other coming together? Well, I'm not. Everybody... You love who you love, you can do what you like.
But what is the basis? Is it procreation?
That is very much part of it.
So what about
that is very much part of it.
People who cannot have children?
Well, That doesn't negate the point of marriage. That doesn't negate it at
all. Why does it not negate the point of marriage in your sense if it is just about procreation?
It's not just about that, but that's the main point of coming together. A husband and wife. Listen, if we're going to make exceptions the rule, then you're never going to have a rule at all, are you? Of course there are couples, heterosexuals, who can't conceive. I completely understand that, but that's not the general
situation. The threshold of morality, surely, is to explore those exceptions and see how those exceptions fit into your belief structure, and to challenge your belief structure because of those exceptions. And otherwise, it becomes a very redundant thing just to say, well, we're going to ignore those exceptions, we're going to ignore those people, and we're just going to talk about the vast majority that fit in.
But isn't that what how democracy is supposed to work? Is that
It's
supposed
democracy
to work?
Democracy, to me, is not just about the rule and the tyranny of the majority. Democracy is about, of course, the majority, but also considering how minority rights are protected, are ensured, and how that everyone can live a life that the majority would expect to be able to live, and that also extends to minority groups as well. And so that is the balance of modern democracy as opposed to Athenian democracy.
Yes, a good point just to take another break, because this is getting very heavy duty, which we expected.
From my side of things,
well, from
yes.
all of us. I think it's very heavy duty stuff, and quite difficult for a lot of people to take on board, because everyone will have a position. They won't be neutral on something that can be as combustible as religion and politics. You know, many of us have been seeing anniversaries of partial decriminalisation of homosexuality, and also the formation of India and Pakistan, mm-hmm. which was all about religion and separating religions, and the political expediency of the day caused millions of people to lose their homes and their lives. Anyway, we are digressing a bit. Lloyd, this is the moment when you tell us what has particularly made a memorable impact on your life in music terms. So tell us all about it.
Well, the album that I've chosen is called This Is My Truth, Tell Me Yours, a quote from Nan Bevan, of the Manic Street Preachers.
Not Porters.
Not as you thought they were. The song is If You Tolerate This, Then Your Children Will Be Next. A song that has a line in it: if you can shoot rabbits, we can shoot fascists. Take the rest of the song as it were. But I remember seeing this the Manic Street Preachers at the Brighton Centre when I was a schoolboy. I really went along because I was more interested in the other boy that was going along, and I was infatuated with him. That infatuation finished, but actually my enjoyment of the Manics has remained. And so it's a good Welsh band that continues to produce. Despite the loss of one of their songwriters, continues to produce good political songs.
Okay, well, let's lay back and listen to it, I guess, and then we'll come back and conclude this discussion. Here they are, the Manic Street Preachers.
The future teaches you to be alone, so I got this one.
Now, Anthea, you've been sitting there very quietly, rolling your eyes occasionally. You figured recently at the start of most full councils, because you were the spiritual support for the mayor, the last mayor.
Wonderful privilege.
Councillor Pete West. Now, the prayers that they have before full councils, they aren't compulsory. So there's a gaggle of humanists and atheists who make a lot of noise outside the chamber. While those people who do have...
They make a lot of noise.
Well, the chatter does carry through. Do you think, actually, that a prayer... and we presumably, Lloyd, they have prayers in Parliament as well? You don't know. You've never attended.
In Parliament they have prayers, but you have to turn your back to the priest. So you... face away from everyone, and then if you attend prayers, you get a reserved seat for the rest of the day, and if you don't attend prayers, then you have to fight.
Oh, so it's nothing to do with spirituality, it's only about getting a reserved seat.
Basically, most of my colleagues only go along if they want a reserved seat, and I find that hypocritical. Personally, I would like people to go along because they want to enjoy the prayers, all well and good, and if they don't want to, then they shouldn't have to.
So it's slightly different in Brighton Hove's City Council chamber, where everyone has a prescribed place because the cameras light on people, and the poor guys on the control panel wouldn't know who's speaking unless they know where they're sitting. So, but do you think in a modern day a moment of contemplation, whether it's interfaith or a particular religious leader saying a prayer and saying some words, does that have a place in modern day political sphere?
It absolutely does, because when you say that I am different from the rest and I don't want to participate in these prayers, you're actually saying I'm not going to participate in what the people who voted for me did, which is, you know, totally hypocritical, because if you have been voted by people of different ethnicities and religions and races and beliefs, if you are a person of respect, you should honour all of them. And that is where I come from as an interfaith minister. I believe that everybody has the right to their views. And prayers are a very beautiful and powerful expression of love and acknowledgement of that which one agrees with and believes in. And you can even do this as an atheist. But I have to say, the thing that you mentioned, which was the group of councillors who stood outside the door and clattered and made a noise and talked, were being doing that kind of sixth form gesture of imbecility, which in fact is very, very contemptuous of the people who voted for them. Totally disrespectful and very naive, the sort of thing that kids do, and very pathetic. And I just consider it to be sad, because I have enormous respect for people of belief. People of belief have died for their beliefs, they've suffered, they've been tortured, and they are people of great intelligence and conviction. You know, people from Gandhi right through to, you know, St. Augustine, they have one thing in common: belief. And the fact of the matter is that people of much greater minds than mine, and all of us sitting here, have been people of belief. And I say, respect them all, because they have brought culture and light and poetry and architecture into our lives. And that is why I'm an interfaith minister.
Now, going back, and you followed in a tradition, actually first started by another Green mayor, Bill Randall, of bringing in other faiths. Now, I remember that didn't always go down well.
I think he did it very well, Geoffrey, to be perfectly honest. Well, I think he did it with good intentions. Interestingly, the road to hell often paved with good intentions. I don't think he did it very cleverly. I think that really it required a bit of introduction, a bit of love, a bit of explanation. And I think he just threw people of different faiths in the deep end, and people didn't really understand why, and I understand the problem.
Mm. I mean, Christina, you objected to one, I think there was an imam, and it got some headlines. You felt it was actually excluding rather than being inclusive to listen to an imam reading from the Quran in Arabic. Why were you offended? Actually, there were others who were, you weren't alone, but you were the go-to person at the time for the media to get a comment, and sure enough, you said what was on your mind. So why did you feel that this excluded you?
I'm surprised. Here's another thing that I've done.
No.
Come on, Geoffrey, give me some slack.
You wouldn't be on the programme unless you had some strong held opinions.
Controversies.
Well, you have good opinions.
Well, yeah, it was, of course, taken out of context insofar as the reaction, again, was instant, which, of course, it does happen on Twitter. Mm-hmm. That's it. But I thought quite clear that I objected it to being in Arabic. I have nothing against Arabs or Arabic. Actually, I'll let you into a secret. My first job was for the airline of Egypt up in London, and I learnt Arabic for a while. That's pretty good going, but, you know, it's very difficult. So I have nothing against that. I just do not like something said, particularly is invoking something religious or whatever, without hearing what it's being said. I want to understand. It's very crucial for me
to understand language. What are people saying? What do they mean? Or what is the point? So it's not that I actually personally, I'd rather that we didn't have that. I'd rather perhaps we didn't have prayers at all. I think that would have been a lot easier, but I do get your point, and they're very much, I get your point that perhaps it should have been introduced and some explanation. I do get that.
This is
point.
What I did.
So there was a throwing in. So I don't think people quite knew what to do with it. I was sitting in the chamber, as I think possibly were you, I don't know. And I'm looking around.
In my other life.
Yeah, well, I had one too. Looking around the chamber, and there were a lot of people not knowing where to put themselves because they didn't know what was being said. And that was my main objection. If he's going to speak or pray from the Quran, let's understand it.
I think there was a translation read out.
I'd like to hear the direct translation. Yeah. Why can't I do that?
Yeah. But, I mean, obviously it was kind of misinterpreted again as being...
Of course it was. And that was by the lovely Warren, who actually I've always got on quite well with, I think. But we had a communication outside of that, and I explained, the position, and he understood it. But I was more disappointed by his initial response publicly, almost saying I'm not fit for public office and I should stand down. I mean, that's just nonsense.
But do you think that's more to do with the tribalism of local politics than really firmly held convictions?
I don't know. You'll have to ask Warren about that. You'll have to ask him about that. But don't forget, as you said, he was the one that brought the notice of motion for same-sex marriage. And actually, he was one of many who emailed me privately and was very complimentary in the stand that I took, albeit that he disagreed with it, and actually said, you know, I will make sure my colleagues won't hit back at you. So a very decent man, I think. So I was somewhat shocked by his reaction publicly to that.
Why didn't he say that publicly rather than just...
Again, you'll have to ask Warren that.
Well, maybe we will. He's been on this show before.
In fact, he has.
He's been on the August show, so who knows, he can defend himself.
It's something of the past, though, Geoffrey. Let's not keep, riding off what happened quite some years ago. We can take the principles and learn, but for me personally, it doesn't matter. It's fine.
But nothing replaces true life experience, and you've been through it. As we all have.
Well, there you go.
I think there is something that I object to about prayers at the beginning of political meetings, council meetings, and Parliament sitting every day, which is different to, and I have no objection to, going to civic and religious services that are held outside of those meetings to support your community. I went along to a really lovely service of the licensing of the new vicar in Woodingdean the other month. And it was very good at bringing the community together, and that's where I think religion and faith really shine and have a real role in our communities, as well as secular meetings. Religious meetings are really important at bringing people together and guiding people through difficult times. I would prefer those 5-10 minutes to be spent having maybe every day, every meeting, a community group come and present some of the work that they're doing in the community in a non-faith spiritual way to remind us as councillors and members of Parliament who we are representing. If we are really talking about remembering what we are representing, we are not representing people because of their faith. We are representing them because of the communities they live in. And that's what we must be reminded about. And it is not offensive to say, OK, that's fine, you can continue to have your prayer session. But that is not something that I think linked to the opening of Parliament or linked to the opening of a council session that has a place in the modern world. You can go ahead with it, but I won't take part. Otherwise, it is hypocritical.
And you're not going to stand outside the chamber noise and rattle your football
I can't remember standing outside the chamber and rattling. At most of those times, I would take that opportunity to go off and get myself a cup of tea.
Lloyd is one of those lovely people that assumes that atheism or non-belief is the default position, is the neutral position.
True.
It's not. Would say it's not. It's you're like saying that that's neutral, any religion is something on top. Actually, I disagree.
I absolutely agree with you. It isn't the default position. And I don't know whether you listened to any of the prayers that I did, but the interfaith prayers, I don't make any attempt to actually extol the virtues of any god, the prayers that I did, which were few because they were mostly prayers from other religious representatives, were actually in praise of our city, in praise of our people, in praise of the things that make us very special, probably in praise of the people who voted for you. So, quite honestly, your censorship, as when prayers should pop up and should not, is about as sensible as me saying, you know, we should have prayers at every other minute of the day. It's completely ridiculous. These are things that have become part of traditions, they've become part of ways of life, they're aspects of prayers which are intrinsically linked to certain things within the Church of England, which I feel are kind of a bit on the heavy side, but I've got to acknowledge them, and I say I open my heart to them as I open my heart to all other faiths, because people have a right to what they believe in, including voting for you.
No one disagrees with any of what you've just said, apart from the fact that...
No one.
Voted
that
you.
How many are you speaking on behalf of? No one.
No one that I know would disagree with most of what you said. But the reality is, should it be part of a formal session of politics, or should it be...
That's not real. That's your opinion.
Should
yes, it's an opinion, not
a
reality.
Wait a second. Or should it not? Or should it not? That's the question. You know, kind of, that's the real question that I think is that we have to tackle in terms of the prayers element. And my view is that it is not appropriate for press, and I did listen to the first, when I first got elected, I of course stayed in and listened to that particular prayer opening, because you have to try something out before you can make a judgment. That's fair enough, but I just didn't feel that was a useful thing in a modern world which is multi-faith and no faith, and I don't think that we should have a assumption that people taking part in prayers is the default either. Our assumption should be that these are very important things for people to reflect on in their own time. These are very important things that play a role in the community, but so does the local football club. But we don't have Whitehawk FC coming along and giving the opening chants a council meeting.
Listen, the world.
No more ridiculous.
We do have hymns at.
Well, there you go. But can
we
do have hymns before
the FA Cup
final. I don't care whether you do or not.
And me and Warren did have to sing Sussex by the Sea at the opening of the Seagulls game the other day.
Part of the progressive movement. Can you stop saying in this modern world? This world has always been multi-faith and none. So stop bringing it into this modern world as if we've progressed.
I'm going to have to call it a halt there. Before a few explosions happen.
No. These are words.
Words.
There's no actions to come with
them. Of course not. I think the Green Party has it right, because before every party meeting, they have something called a moment of attunement.
And then they kill each other.
And then they kill each other. And then they're meant to think about lovely spiritual things and what they're there for. But thank you very much, all of you, for coming into the studio and expressing your views. It's a short programme to tackle a rather complex and, as you say, Christina, nuanced issue. But thank you again for coming in.
Thank you.
The Politics Show on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM.
If nothing else, this programme has shown that religious convictions, when mixed in a highly motivated political setting, can prove to be a very combustible cocktail indeed. My thanks go to my guests today for sharing their views so honestly and robustly. If you want to continue the conversation, please visit the show's webpage on Radio Reverb's website, radioreverb.com. Thank you for listening.